Welcome to Conversations with Tom. Tonight we have a special guest, Mr. Billy Roper, and we're going to be talking about some really interesting and fun topics. I promise, Billy, we're not going to cover anything we usually cover, so this will be a little bit of a fun conversation for you all to listen to. Now, I'll remind you, all opinions expressed on this show are, as always, the opinion of their guests, do not reflect the national right or myself, and if you're listening to this, you probably know that already. So with that in mind, let's start the show. Billy, I just want to say thank you for coming on. I really appreciate that you've had me on the Roper Report several times, and it's a pleasure to have you on to speak this evening.
It's great to be on your show, Tom. I look forward to our conversation, like always.
All right, so this is going to be a lot of fun because Billy and I had the opportunity to meet face-to-face down in Tennessee this summer for the first time, and we really had a great conversation where we got into stuff like alternative history, looking at different things for the future, and as he is a very accomplished novelist in his own right with the Haste and the Day trilogy, as well as many other books talking about the future, I thought it would be a great chance to kind of talk to Billy about the future, not in terms of what we're going to face, you know, 3 days from now, 3 weeks from now, or 3 years from now, but what victory actually looks like and what a successful future might be, what the challenges are that we're all going to face. And for those of us that sometimes have to have laser eye focus on the ethnostate and the questions of how whites are going to survive this challenging time, I think it's so helpful to kind of imagine a future where, you know, we are successful and we have a place in our society that befits our talents. So with that in mind, I sort of prompted Billy that we would be talking about this a little bit tonight. And I kind of will start with the first question, which is, what does the happy ending look like for you? What do you imagine when you picture why this fight is worth all the effort? And in your case, all the years you've dedicated to this effort?
That's a great question, Tom. You know, often in the struggle that we're in and the cause that we are dedicated to, we find ourselves trying to express to people what we are opposed to, what we would like to destroy. And I think it's really important that we kind of do the flip side of that and offer something positive and upbeat to people, something optimistic, to let them know what it is that we want to create and what we want to replace the current system with, and like you said, the end goal in the extreme future. Now, obviously, we all know what it is that we quote-unquote hate, but it's more important to emphasize what we love because that's a much more powerful and constructive emotion. And we are creators. We're going to be builders of the future. It's much more important to think about in the long term what we're going to build than in the very short term what we're going to have to overcome to get there. So thinking in the long term, if I were to imagine, you know, 1,000 years from now, or even hopefully once we get technology exponentially accelerating and building on itself, 1 century from now, I can really envision a solar system with colonies of Caucasian Homo sapiens that have lunar bases, that have bases in the asteroid belts, that have bases on Mars and perhaps, you know, on some of the moons of the outlying planets, and have even spread past the outer perimeters of the closest 9 planets to us out of our solar system to other systems. And the reason why I envision that, because if you look at the history of the Earth and of our species and indeed of other species that have been on this planet, the dinosaurs, for example, faced a huge die-off, you know, when they had an asteroid collision with Terra that changed the environment so radically and so quickly that they didn't have time to adapt. And, you know, according to the evolutionary theory, that made it possible for our ancestors to rise to prominence, also doomed most of them. And we could suffer the same fate, whether it's global thermonuclear war or destruction of our environment or another asteroid. I don't like the idea of our species as a whole having all of its proverbial eggs in one basket. So I would really like for us to expand the technology to get our species off planet and at least have a chance for it to survive and continue that wonderful natural selection process. And, you know, as you and I have talked about before, the way that natural selection works is through competition. Competition between subspecies of a species to determine which is, you know, as Darwin wrote, most favored. And they compete through territorial battles over land and resources, and sometimes mates, and all but one that most fit become extinct through that natural selection competition process, and that new de facto species, the one surviving subspecies, then subdivides again within itself through internal competition, through climatic and other environmental adaptations, as they become new de facto subspecies or races. That eternal honing process continues, and natural selection process requires nature to stay, you know, red in tooth and claw. So true diversity is necessary for the continued evolution of the species, but multiracialism blunts, destroys the true diversity necessary for evolution to continue by breeding back to the mean, to the less evolved, and the most evolved, the most recent adaptations are recessive. So they're more fragile and more easily blunted back to the mean through, you know, back breeding back to the more primitive form. For example, blue and green eyes are recessive compared to brown, and lighter colored hair to darker colored hair, and same thing is for skin, but of course, race is much more than just those very small, you know, physical characteristics. Most of what is race cannot be seen with the naked eye. But basically, in the long term, I would love to see our species differentiate so much within itself as only whites being part of that species, that, for example, we'd be able to genetically engineer through eugenics white people who are able biologically to breathe in a methane atmosphere of a planet or to survive in a gravity well five times that of our own on Earth. And in other words, differentiate through even genetic manipulation our species so much that its survival, or at least the descendants of its species' survival, would be ensured.
That's really interesting to imagine, you know, the level of genetic engineering you're talking about where, you know, say you were on the moon, for instance, where the gravity is much lower and, you know, maybe you learn to breathe in a different atmosphere. And it seems to me that technology offers opportunities potentially to rework our genetics in a way where we realize a greater ability within us. But it also seems that the alternative is equally possible, where we might end up with some grotesque experiments. And it's kind of an interesting point to wonder about. I know that, at least I believe you're a Christian man, and yeah. I know that there is profound uncertainty with tinkering with what God has wrought. And the question, you know, when people look at genetic engineering often, is do we have the wisdom within ourselves, or do we even have the right, I guess you would say, to go ahead and look and tinker at that? So I'm curious to hear how you ethically balance some of those questions about, you know, the desire for betterment that is the natural impulse that I think we all experience through evolution versus the question of, you know, is there something unique that is man? Is there something that is greater, that's deeper than our code that we risk losing, you know? Like, if you listen to a transhumanist and they say, we'll upload a person into the machine and they'll live forever, but is it still a person? So I wonder, for your sake, how do you see some of those questions balancing?
Oh, yeah, that's brilliant. Yeah, so obviously, if you think about what people are most concerned about today when it comes to genetic manipulation, we're still in the beginning. You know, nanotechnology is just a fledgling primitive proto-science, but people are concerned, for example, about, you know, GMOs. Genetically modified organisms. And they have this idea that if a food crop, for example, is a GMO, that it's somehow, you know, intrinsically unhealthy and can cause some kind of mutations within the human body or cellular structure just by eating that GMO corn, for example. Well, that's, I think, kind of Luddite superstition, because we have been genetically modified organisms for as long as we have domesticated food crops. I mean, if you look at what Gregor Mendel did, the famous monk, his first studies, which led to our understanding of what DNA is, was through studying hybridization and through crossbreeding different plant breeds and making new ones. You know, we have food crops that can grow in different temperate climates and different amounts of rain or lower amounts of rain, because they've been genetically modified, they've been crossbred into hybrids, and we could not really maintain the agricultural output that we have in modern Western civilization had it not been for that genetic modification of food crops that we now know today, which are completely different from the food crops that we know our ancestors knew as native wild plants that they domesticated. And on the animal sense, you know, we went to the county fair a couple of days ago, and all of us are familiar with what modern-day domesticated chickens look like, especially in our grocery stores once they've been processed, but even before. You think about the big, you know, Tyson, for example, food processors. Now, I'm not a big fan of injecting animals with growth hormones, which I think can be detrimental to human consumption and actually cause an increased acceleration of puberty, for example, or the onset of puberty. So that's a negative. The steroids are negative. But we had an opportunity a couple days ago to actually see what old English laying hens, chickens, looked like before they were ever crossbred and hybridized. And, you know, Tom, they're about the size of pigeons. So obviously they would not have been as very satisfying, you know, for either eggs or for a meat product. So once again, our ancestors have been genetically modifying through hybridization and crossbreeding, even our domestic animals and livestock. You think about, you know, the aurochs or the oxen or, you know, the Scottish Highland cattle that were the first domesticated livestock that we have, and compare that with the different specialized breeds of cattle that exist today. You know, the Hereford cattle and the Angus cattle, you know, which are specifically bred for meat production. And there are Jersey cows, which are a breed specifically made for milk production. All these specializations and hybridizations are different subspecies within species for a specific purpose, and that's really a form of GMO. That's a genetically modified organism. But so we've already been doing it. It's not really a question of whether or not to do it. You know, it's just a question of to what degree.
And well, let me interject for 1 second, if I can, sure, because a question occurs to me, which is, I think that people would be willing to concede that hybridization has been healthy in a lot of ways, although people make that same argument for the human race in a lot of ways, and I know you disagree with it there because you see the value of retaining certain traits of the breed. And I think the question people have with GMOs, amongst other things, is do you trust the people who are doing the mixing? And I think this is a valuable question because, let's be honest, agribusiness at this point is mostly business, slightly agriculture. And we see companies like Monsanto that have, you know, agendas where they're designed to optimize profits. But a lot of times I've noticed that capital-intensive systems tend to value short-term gains and outlays versus long-term expenses. So, like, when they mixed, I remember back in the 90s, the big stink was they mixed the tomato with the fish so it would last longer. So the two things that kind of scared me personally about was, number one, do they understand everything they're getting? They're mixing a gene in there for the expression of a trait of longevity, but do they understand everything else? Just like we see with big pharma, you know, you watch any commercial on TV and they'll see, like, go ahead and take pill X. Pill X will solve this. And then they spend the next 3 minutes with pictures of a happy family telling you all the ways it's going to kill you before the next infomercial comes on about how 10 years from now you hire a lawyer for the lawsuit against the people who took that pill. And it's how do you trust this? I mean, this is the problem, right? We're in such a low-trust society in a lot of ways that even if we could imagine a better eugenic way to approach things, who are the good actors? And that's what worries me about it. I mean, I'm a brat. I eat organic food. I eat farm fresh food, okay? And I know the people who make the food. Sometimes I know the food before it is the food. And I trust it because I see it. And maybe that's simplistic. But I feel like in some ways, and I understand it doesn't scale upwards. And I make a lot of sacrifices so that I can enjoy those things. But this is kind of like the crux of the question, right? Is it better having quality with, you know, a sacrifice of the amount we can take care of? Or are we better off with the quantity? Because as you say, and I have no doubt of this, we could never have the yields we require without some of the changes that we've wrought. But is more always better? I don't know.
That's right. I also agree with you that quality is more important than quantity. We've been facing the same question about whether we should trust the people in charge of, you know, a production of food ever since the you know, yellow journalism era of the 1920s with Upton Sinclair in the jungle. You know, opportunity to expose what happened in the meat processing business. It was still a pretty grotesque book, if you ever read it. And obviously,
Indeed. Yeah,
it's pretty disgusting, but that still has not changed today. I mean, if you've ever watched a YouTube video of how a chicken McNugget is made, that's not pretty palatable either. Yeah, I agree with you. You know, I believe people should eat as natural and organic a diet as possible. And actually, we had a radio program last night where I was talking about how National Socialism, which I'm a National Socialist, we're actually encouraged, you know, through Walter Dahr's idea, the idea of blood and soil, a return to agrarianism and actually almost a rejection of superseding technology. In German, the two terms that are used are Gemeinschaft and Gesellschaft. Gemeinschaft refers to a natural, smaller, organic community, and then Gesellschaft is like a cosmopolitan, larger civilization. And the idea from Walter Dahr, from the blood and honor idea, sorry, the blood and soil idea, is that you would revert back to Gemeinschaft from Gesellschaft and have a more smaller, organic, quality-based community where people are familiar, like we talked about last night, with where their food comes from. As you said, know your food before it is your food. And so many people today, you know, in this modern Western civilization, is the problem is that they think that meat comes cellophane wrapped with styrofoam backing in their grocery freezer, and, you know, produce comes sprayed every 5 seconds with, you know, insecticides and herbicides. And like I said, I believe that those are unhealthy, as well as steroids and growth hormones, very unhealthy, especially for humans. I think that's the key. As far as the ethical question, that is the red line that a lot of people draw, is when it comes to our species being tinkered with. You know, I think that, for example, we've all seen those very alarming pictures of, you know, the mouse with the human ear being grown on its back as a replacement. And we all feel that there's probably a better way of doing that than combining mouse and human DNA to recreate an ear. I'm sure there are other ways. And that, you know, because that is kind of off-putting for us. The reality is, you know, my grandmother died a couple of years ago. She had within her heart a porcine valve, a pig valve that had been transplanted into her heart 25 years ago that had kept her heart beating. So this, again, is not something completely new, and they've been doing it, you know, in cardiac surgery for a generation. And that's not to say that maybe there are better ways, but that is a reality. As far as
it kept her alive, that's pretty good.
And better than an artificial heart piece would have done. So in terms of human ethics, yeah, at what point do you end humanity? Where does the soul reside? Where is that spark? What part can you remove that remaining is no longer human? And so actually, you know, in my book, Remnants, science fiction, far future novel, I kind of took the idea, you know, from Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, which was turned into The Blade Runner by Philip K. Dick, the idea of replicants, of androids that have, as far as they are aware, human memories and human consciousness, and it kind of asked the question, you know, where does sentience begin and where does consciousness turn into humanity? And so, you know, with that book explored, I kind of took a step further, where we have a future technology that I envisioned that people were able to, much more than my grandmother was able to, replace worn-out parts. So today we have organ transplants, and some people who are extraordinarily wealthy, like, you know, the Mr. Rockefeller that just passed away, can have multiple organ transplants. They can have new kidneys and new hearts and new lungs, and they can cannibalize other people for decades and live a very long life. And,
the blood transfusions, I think, of where they'd have children's blood regularly transported into their veins, which has shown in the studies that do exist that, in fact, it keeps people alive longer. It has a certain vitality to it from the youth.
And cannibalize almost in a vampiric way, people.
Indeed.
So if people are able to do that now, imagine if technology increases over the next 3 or 4 decades and we don't waste valuable resources and scientific technology trying to keep billions of third worlders alive. If we just focus on helping our own people and increasing our own civilization technology, we could literally make artificial organs to replace almost any human organ that was to wear out. And what I envisioned was a potential future where that occurred, where we had control of our destiny once again, spent resources on ourselves once again, and literally were able to, piece by piece, or, you know, en masse, replace wearing out human bodies with artificial bodies, and that really led to brain transplants. Now, as you talked about, you know, some people envision the possibility of somehow uploading consciousness, you know, through the cloud or through the Ethernet or even to Android in a more primitive sense. But, yeah, what is consciousness? Where is that divine spark? Where does the soul reside? And, you know, I think that there were the Greeks, I think, believed that it was in the abdomen, in our intestines. And some people have thought since then that it was in the heart. In the Renaissance, they believed that the spirit, the soul lived in the heart. And then in the modern era, if we were to say if there's any organ in the physical human body that would hold our soul, we think, well, that's the brain. And so we can replace almost any organ from the neck down, and it would just be a replaceable part. We could replace it with artificial or with other people's organs, and it wouldn't make a difference. But if you replace that brain, that's no longer consciousness, no longer, and that's where our memory resides. That's where our consciousness and our sense of self reside. Well, is that true? I mean, could you perhaps replace parts of the brain? If one were to stop functioning, could you actually take neural flesh and connect it with the still functioning part? And if someone had a traumatic brain injury, could you, you know, replace those dead cells and allow them to regrow their neural networks and function once again? And if so, does that mean that the brain itself is not necessary? At what point, you know, so that's what I tried to envision. Where do you draw that line? And it's hard to say, consciousness. Now, in terms of having a soul, I'm going to do something a little bit off here, because as you mentioned, I'm a Christian. And so a lot of people listening to this program might say, well, he's talking about evolution, he's talking about natural selection, but he says he's a Christian. I'm a Christian idealist, and I don't necessarily feel that my spiritual views have to conform with anyone else's dogma or anyone else's doctrine. I try to reconcile my beliefs between myself and my God, and I don't really care what anyone else thinks. You know, that's all that matters to me. I'm consider myself to be a logical, rational person, and that's how I weigh things, also based on faith. And what my logic and my rationality tells me in terms of that, as a Christian identist, which is a racial religion, and we believe that literally in Genesis chapter 1, you have the creation of the pre-Adamic non-white races. In Genesis chapter 2, you have the creation of Adam, who is the first white man, and Eve, his wife. And therefore, since Adam was, in Genesis chapter 2, breathed a soul into by God, and the pre-Adamic non-white races were not, only white people have souls. I'm going really fast in this, not trying to proselytize, but I'm just trying to explain my perspective. So what that means is that...
Take a moment, and just because people might be interested in that, if you would recommend a source or two just for people who want to have a better understanding, and then we'll go forward, because it's an interesting philosophy. I'm somewhat aware of it. I've read a little bit about it, but for people who want to learn more, since you're an adherent, I think they'd appreciate that.
Sure, okay, so a Christian identity, they can read more online. I recommend people like Pastor Richard Butler, who was the reverend who brought me back to faith when I was an apostate and was agnostic for most of my adult life, because I had seen too much hypocrisy and contradictions within the modern Judeo-Christian church. So I've actually rejected it and fell from faith for most of my adult life. But he was able to show me rationally and logically, from my perspective, how Christian identity belief was not counter-science or counter-logic. And he actually began that with discussing the dietary laws and how the Old Testament dietary laws were really their attempt just to establish health codes, because they noticed, hey, if you eat undercooked pork, and they didn't understand what trichinosis was, that you get sick and you could die. So it's not a good idea to eat pig. Very simple. But, of course, that becomes encoded into law, and the legend becomes superstition, becomes myth. And, you know, now they don't really know the logical reason why. But he helped me to understand the logic and rationality behind it. So I encourage people to look up, you know, Pastor Richard Butler, and they can watch his sermons on YouTube, and they can, you know, he perhaps can explain Christian identity. I'm a dual seed line Christian identist, which explains my view of those who call themselves the Jews. But in terms of thinking about the ethics of where the soul resides, which is why I mentioned my faith, if, as Christian identists, we believe that only white people have souls, and we have souls because God breathed the breath of life into Adam, the first white man, because Adam in Hebrew means to be able to show blood in the face, to be able to blush. And he did not do that for the non-whites, who
were pre-Adamic in Genesis chapter 1, who were like beasts of the field. They were told to be fruitful and multiply and to have dominion over the earth, but they failed that dominion mandate. There is no one to till the earth. So that would indicate that only white people have souls, and if so, it is our genetic lineage, our DNA, that makes it possible. So I believe only white people have souls. Now, what that means is that if you think of, in a corporal sense, an analogy might be, if you were a potter and you were going to make a vessel of clay and you carefully formed this face and you fired it, obviously that vessel is going to be a great bearer of water. If you take the same vessel in the same form with the same clay, but you add an admixture of sand or field dirt to your clay, whenever you fire that vessel, it's not going to be able to hold water. And so I would say that that would be an analogy that someone who is racially mixed, who is not exactly white, can no longer hold a soul in their corporal body any more than that mixed vessel of clay and sand, once fired, could hold water within it. So I would say that how we define consciousness and our spirit or our soul, you know, whenever we start to tinker with our genetic makeup, I think, from my perspective, whether or not we hybridize these subspecies of a species is more crucial than where we go from there in terms of changing, you know, if you can survive a more dense gravity well, or, you know, be taller with leaner muscle mass to survive in a lighter one, that kind of thing.
But this is curious to me, though, because I want to tease this out. It wasn't where I thought the conversation would go, but that's the way conversations with me always go. That, so if you imagine the soul is contained by the fact, by something about being white, being Caucasian, and
yeah,
that in the event that you mix races, that it gets diluted, we'll use, I think that's a fair word. So in your mind, it would seem to me logical, and correct me if you disagree, that the nature of the entirety of whatever we are is what enables our soul, rather than saying that it's some snippet of DNA that's in our code that, you know, can be transferred across and between groups, that, you know, that there's something about holding it together in your definition that seems to me that gives us a soul. So I would wonder how you would reconcile that with your vision of the future, where you see genetic adjustment, let's call it, or genetic improvement even, to fit new environments, if that would potentially threaten it, because at that point, then you really are dealing with a different DNA set, and I'm curious how you reconcile that.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like I see eugenics as a whole, either positive or a negative, because we talk about, you know, eugenics, there's both the carrot and the stick, there's both ways of doing it. I see eugenics as a whole of just being an acceleration of nature, and I see nature as just being an expression of God's will. And so literally, for example, natural selection happens in a macro sense, in a micro sense, every single day, you know, and we can see it happening on a generational level. It doesn't necessarily take eons to be expressed. So the harsher, the more extreme the stress is on the survival of any population, the more rapidly adaptation and natural selection happens. So a particular trait can be selected for more quickly when the threat to survival is, you know, more extreme. So obviously nature works at different speeds at different times depending on what is going on in the environment around it. So we also...
Do you see nature as a force of God, though, in some way pushing the development of a soul as maybe a growing entity? Because
yeah.
I take it that you're a dualist. Is that fair in saying that there's a separation between body and soul?
Yeah, absolutely. I believe that the soul can and does survive the body. I believe that our souls existed prior to the existence of our bodies.
Okay.
So really, if we were to say, if nature's an expression of God and natural selection happens through God's will, then we accelerating natural selection, or are we helping to steer natural selection through eugenics, is not contrary to God's will. It's simply, you know, an acceleration of it or a steering of it. And for example, we know that basically to a large degree, you know, you and me are the same as our ancestors were 1,000 years ago. That's true in a general sense. You know, we have the same general minds. We have the same cognitive abilities, pretty much.
We benefit probably from advanced nutrition. That's probably the biggest gain, nutrition, sanitation.
Exactly, and from experience, and from, you know, sure, amassed knowledge. We see as far as we can by standing on the shoulders of giants, previous generations. But that built-up knowledge doesn't really preclude the fact that even though we're largely the same people as our ancestors, there are measurable, minute differences in DNA, if nothing else, through back through hybridization, back through crossbreeding. You know, you and I are different ethnicities, right? And we
absolutely
are different, and we are different ethnicities than either of our ancestors were 1,000 years ago. Like, for example, if we were to do your genealogical studies or mine, you know, we'd probably find a tangled web of family trees stretching back to each of us having at least 3 or 4 different European ethnicities or, you know, nation identities that made us who we are today. And that in itself is not natural selection per se. That is human beings making a choice that made us who we are, which is slightly different from what our ancestors each were. So it's only a matter of degrees between that and saying that, okay, you know, I had an ancestor, perhaps, who had brown eyes, and it may have been the fact that, you know, at some point, they and their descendants began to gradually move northwards into a more northern European climate, and those descendants were selected to be better suited for survival in that particular climate if they had blue or green eyes, you know, or lighter colored hair. That's natural selection. That's
now, I know an Arkansas boy isn't making the argument that moving north is better, are you?
Well, hey, let me throw this out there. Hey, honestly, you know, my ancestors, you know, came to be what they are, if you want to use the term evolved, in a climate, in latitudinally speaking, much more similar to yours than to mine. Absolutely. Yeah.
It's an interesting argument I've had from time to time, just to interject, with our good southern friends like yourself, that, you know, up here in New England and in the north, we actually, as you rightly said, live in environments more akin to where our genetic ancestors lived. And it's interesting to see the interplay between why history keeps you there, where maybe your genetics would theoretically call you back north.
And if there were no other adaptations to be made culturally or environmentally, and we were simply adapting to nothing other than our environment over time, people in my latitude would revert back to the mean of having fewer instances of blonde hair and blue eyes and more of brown hair and brown eyes to this environment. So that ancestor line in the distant past who chose to move north and adapted to that northern European environment and developed lighter features, made that choice to move, and because of that choice he made and the choice of, you know, subsequent generations making a similar choice to move further north and to stay there, that made me what I am. So really, it's not too much of an extrapolation to say that us to make a choice that we're going to make it possible for our descendants to live on a different planet with different environment or atmosphere, and just rather than taking a few steps northwards, we're going to take a few steps in terms of genetically engineering and tweaking our DNA, and that's really only a question of degrees. I don't think it's any more unnatural. So I don't think it's really within the purview of us to judge, hey, this is God's will, and this is in God's design and God's purpose in nature, and that is unnatural. That is against God's will. I think that everything that happens is God's will for his greater glory, not for ours. And so, you know, there's nothing that's not part of his plan.
I think that's the nature of what God has to be. I think the Calvinists had it right, but it's a dour thing for most people to live with these days.
Mm-hmm.
Something I wonder about, though, and I'm going to shift this slightly because I think it's interesting. You spend a lot of time talking about natural selection, but as we know, the theory of evolution, stated simply, says organisms which are best suited to their environment are most likely to survive. And unfortunately, one thing I think we've seen in terms of our own social evolution is that as we've become more adept with tools, and technology is really just an expression of tools, in a lot of ways, I would make the argument that we have actually become less capable and less able to do things for ourselves. And this is something that very much concerns me, that, you know, we've lost some of our abilities as individuals, as people, in exchange for having a comfortable social setting. And as I see artifice growing and artificiality growing, I worry very much that, in fact, we will gladly surrender our humanity, our potentiality, for some sort of safe, secure existence, becoming the slug that's crawled into a cave where there's no predation. And I think this is one of the challenges that's at the root of all this movement, and I know you as a National Socialist are going to think this way, that if we're not striving, if we're not pushing, then we slide into this sort of backslide where we do what I would argue white civilization did. It got on top, it got comfortable, it got lazy, and then it started looking for ways to get around doing things. And we were so clever that we sort of decreased our own utility. I mean, and I think that's one of the real challenges we have going forward in the big picture, because on the one hand, we can imagine all these tools, and we can imagine clever ways we play with things with artificiality and manipulations. But on the other hand, I wonder if we're not losing something in that process, and if we don't threaten ourselves to lose our very existence, because we'll try to find some way that's so clever to avoid doing work that we cease to be human.
Yeah, in the year 2525, right? Yeah, it's chaos.
True.
It's entropy, and the reason why, you know, when you stare into the abyss like that, the abyss stares right back at you like Nietzsche wrote. So, yeah, obviously in the 19th century, there was this scientist and agronomist, his name was Thomas Malthus, and what he said, the Malthusian theory, was that, you know, we have the civilizations that rise, they produce food to feed the populations until eventually things are too easy and too soft, and they breed too many people that outstrips their ability to feed those people, and then the population then has a collapse, a bottleneck of people dying off, and the civilization then collapses through people just dying off. And then they are once again able to feed that level of people, and it booms once again. So you have this cycle of population bottlenecks and booms and busts. But Malthus did not foresee the Industrial Revolution, which made possible mass agriculture, the ability to feed way too many people. So the Earth has now got, you know, 8 billion people, and 6 billion of them are just stuff to fill graves with. They're completely useless consumers. And so absolutely, quantity is more important than quality. Malthus missed the boat on the Industrial Revolution, but what we need to do to make sure that we have control of that entropy is why I'm a National Socialist, because obviously technology expands, and if people are able to, we have an idiocracy where people are lazy and rootless and fruitless and do nothing more than just satisfy their most, you know, facial bestial urges. And if things devolve down to the mean or even lower. And the way we avoid that is by having National Socialism, which means that, no, we don't have equality, and technology is not used for your creature comforts. Technology is not used for your luxury. Technology is actually focused for quality, to promote the best aspects of our species, so that the purpose of a state is to hold, is to be a vessel, to hold the race, and to answer every question of foreign or domestic policy based on the very single stipulation, the very single criteria of whether or not it's in the best interest of the race as a whole. Anything that's in the best interest of the race as a whole, collectively, is good. Any policy that is in the worst interest of the race as a whole is bad. We don't focus on individual freedom or luxury. We focus on collective responsibility and duty, and we then avoid entropy. We then avoid systemic rot that comes with democracy and the luxury that can be brought by technology. So we have to have National Socialism to make sure that we continue to use technology as a tool to move forward. And any tool, whether it is a gun or an automobile, can be used for good or for bad or just for waste. And we need to make sure that we have direction, not aimlessness, to this technology. And that's why, you know, we won't have to worry so much about ethical issues in terms of whether some mad scientist is going to try to make a hybrid in the future between you know, my great grandkid and a tree sloth, just for, you know, kicks and giggles, right? But rather there will be oversight of that technology. And then the question is, obviously, as you go all the way to the top, who watches the watchers, who is, you know, overseeing the overseers? But ultimately we have to say, if you believe in, if you're monotheist, if you believe in God, then at some point the buck stops. At some point you have to say, this is the final arbiter of authority in which I place de facto trust, because there is nothing greater. In terms of National Socialism, that means that if you actually create a government which acts in your people's collective interest, rather than randomly or through democracy and mob rule, then you can actually have to trust that new ultimate de facto authority as being the best of all possible worlds, you know, Dr. Pangloss. So,
Well, this is interesting, because you're right. So I'm going to play devil's advocate for a moment and see what you come up with, because that's what I do. I'm difficult like that. And I think that's why people like coming on my show, because I like to probe. And because I find it fascinating, and I really do. So one of the things that you mentioned heavily in your last description was the importance of the collective. But one of the things that I've observed with a lot of people in movement is that individualism is very important to them, especially people who take a eugenic mindset. And I say this in the sense that a lot of people who I've met have kind of re-embraced a sort of primitivism and a basic sort of reapproach to what was out there. I mean, the idea is as old as Marx and older than that, that, you know, even communism comes from communalism, going back to an imagined pristine state, or if you imagine it in a Christian sense, teleologically, you're going back to the Garden of Eden. And a lot of people would say when it was just the simple individual man or the individual woman that they were focused, they were self-sufficient, they were capable, and that the process of collectivization is in fact somewhat dysgenic in and of itself, because what it does is it increases specialization at the cost of having a degree of ability in the individual characters, and that is so transformative that it actually kind of is destructive to the very idea of a collective, because people are so specialized they can't interrelate. And if you look at what we have today with the Internet, you know, what it's really – I don't think the Internet created all the divisions that exist in society. It just revealed them as we see people branching off in 1,000 different directions and different movements, and that you see the collective torn apart by the very specialization that the whole idea of a collective identity requires. And a lot of people who I talk to, including some people I've interviewed on here who are very smart, say that the answer is, in fact, the opposite of what you're suggesting. It's rerooting in the individual, rerooting in the idea that you can be the person who is responsible for your own destiny and becoming generalist instead of specialist. So what I would ask you is how you see that relationship between not just the collective and the individual, but also between the general and the specialist, because it seems like so much of what we deal with are the question of these tensions. And my general impression is within the movement that a lot of people who are broadly sympathetic to identitarian movements actually end up having a very regressive mindset about things rather than having, you know, confidence and optimism that the future can see anything other than a diminution of our actual human potential.
I think that one of the failures of the educational system, the public educational system in Western civilization, is that it is still an extension of the dregs of the Enlightenment. And one of the dregs of the Enlightenment that infected even our founding fathers in the United States, you know, because they were subject to it as well and strongly influenced by that French idea. Man, you know, if I had a time machine and I could go back and do one thing, I think I might go back and give a spanking to Jean-Jacques Rousseau, you know, the idea of the noble savage, right?
Because you don't like the social contrast, huh?
No, I don't. Because, okay, that kind of, you know, reflects what you're talking about. Rousseau said that, hey, we have this noble savage, that if you revert people back to the individual level, then they are pretty much morally good. And that, you know, the noble savage has good instincts, and it doesn't necessarily apply itself to morality, but you don't need morality.
But let's be fair. Rousseau borrowed that. I mean, that's as old as the Bible itself. An antediluvian man has always been posited as morally superior. The Greeks wrote about, you know, the age of the golden man and the silver man and the iron man, and everyone imagines. I mean, most Western civilizations have a recurring theme of imagining their more esteemed forebearers, whether it's Romulus and Remus or whether it's Adam. So I agree with what you're saying that maybe it's problematic, but I would say he was borrowing or appropriating an existing cultural theme, putting perhaps the sort of happy Indian spin on it that existed of his time frame, but I don't think it's novel.
No, and Romulus Remus maybe could practice real individualism by each finding their own wolf, but, you know, they practice collectivism by just going after a different tip, right, on the same wolf. So go ahead and think about the Greeks. Like you mentioned the Greeks, you know, we think about politics and political structure. We think about Plato and his republic and the structure that he wrote about. You know, it was not based on individualism. It was not libertarian at all. It was actually collectivist fascist society where you have these noble philosopher kings who are selected by their intellect and rule a very hierarchical and structured society, a very collectivist society. Which is just as much as part of Western civilization prior to it being poisoned in Athens into democracy, which is not what we think of as democracy today. You know, and so I believe Plato had a collectivist, fascist, if not national socialist, worldview in mind. Of course, the whole idea of the word utopia means there's no such thing, but he was trying to express what he thought would be a better system, and his better system would be philosopher kings in a very structured hierarchy, collectivist system. And so, you know, going back to the noble savage, going back to individual, you know, yeah, the Enlightenment and whatever came before that led into the Enlightenment, I think has poisoned a lot of people to want to be individualists because the idea, if we have technology, if we have science, and we want to apply that technology and that science to the betterment of our race as a whole, individualism would tell us that we just want to preserve our own genes and our own DNA, and that's really no more than a political reflection of the biological urge to reproduce, which is probably the most powerful urge that there is. People probably would prefer to satiate that urge rather than the urge to eat if they have a choice, I think studies have shown. But
isn't that what we have, though? You're right. That's the realization of what we have today. I mean, that's why cheap sex works, right? Because it's something that everyone wants, even though it's incredibly socially destructive. I mean, it makes people totally uninvested in the next generation just because they think they can have a lot.
I think something more noble and elevated, something more idealistic, is what do we think of as being heroic? What do we call a martyr? We think of a hero and a martyr being someone who puts others' interests ahead of their own, even someone who's willing to sacrifice their life for their fellow man or for the greater good or for the collective best interest of those around them. That's a hero and that's a martyr. And in our hearts, idealistically, that's what we think of as being the most noble of human sentiments. Greater love hath no man than he lay down his life for his friend. And so we would think about not being selfish. You know, I'm not in this movement because I want to create, even if I have the technology, clones of Billy Roper. I am insulin-dependent diabetic, and I'm nearsighted and flat-footed, right? I want future generations of our race to be far, far better than me. I hope they are so much better than me that I, in comparison, when they look back, look like a Neanderthal compared to them, and that they think we came from that, and that'd be fine, because that's the whole idea. And ideally, you know, parents are supposed to tell their kids, I hope you have a better life than I did. I hope you are smarter, more successful than I have been. That's nobility. And in terms of genetics and genetic manipulation and technology and natural selection, we also should want our species and our race, which will be our de facto species, to be better than we are. So that means that we should not think in terms of being selfish individuals, wanting to replicate ourselves, but we should want to improve the collective whole, even if that means something better than ourselves. If I literally, and I am not speaking hyperbolically, if I literally, Tom, could tonight, as we have this conversation, eliminate all the non-white competitors on our planet, and the least intelligent two-thirds of our race, and as a cost, myself, I'd be extinct and my bloodline gone, I'd make the sacrifice without hesitation. And I know that a lot of people are not willing to get away from that individualist idea and that sentiment of selfishness, and really any political movement that they get involved in, whether it's communism or national socialism or something in between, is going to be a vehicle to move forward their own selfish interests, whether it's economic or biological. the best of us, I think, have to be a little bit more elevated in our sentiments and more nobly and ideally minded than that, and think of what is in the collective interest of the greater good of our people as a whole, not ourselves. And every hero of our race who has ever voluntarily, consciously given his life for his people had that higher and noble idea. They were not selfish. And we've lost a lot of that. And consumer capitalism has really destroyed a lot of that nobility of spirit, but it's still there. And it needs to be recaptured and brought back to the surface for the betterment of our whole race.
Well, you know, one of the things that has struck me for some time is that we don't have high culture anymore. We just have one populist democratic culture that is non-aspirational, right? It doesn't demand anything of people. It basically says if it feels good, do it. And what you're talking about is a call to consideration of a much larger view of things. And while I don't know that I'm mentally prepared to go as far as you are about certain things, I would say something that I think you and I can talk about that a lot of people wouldn't understand, and I will try to explain it because I certainly see it in the roles I've served in public service as well as, you know, in this movement, which is that the morality of a collectivist thinker is somewhat different than an individual. When you're an individual, you think very simply, right? You think you don't want to or do no harm, or that you don't want to cause problems, or you want to be helpful to people. But what happens, and I think a lot of people shy away from these hard conversations, because it really forces you to face both awful and tremendous decisions that are very defining, which is to say that sometimes you have to do something that is so incredibly painful in the short term that will be beneficial in the long term. And when you talk about the sort of sacrifice, you know, considering, you know, the death of thousands, you know, or millions or whatever it is. I mean, on the one hand, you know, that's really the choice this movement faces. If we're really honest with it, we could go along comfortably for the next 50 years and have the white race essentially disappear and be bred into whatever other combination that it exists in. And then we'll continue on as whatever that is and whatever person believes that is. Or at some point, we're going to be forced to find some way to separate ourselves or, you know, protect or preserve what is our own, and that will probably have a very high social cost. But the social cost paid up front, however many thousands of people it is that get engaged in conflict, has the potential benefit of the millions who will live. And I think people don't necessarily easily understand the idea that the people who are leaders in this movement are trying to ask the question of how to preserve our future against the today that says that we don't have the right to do so. And I hope and would wish that there was a happy, easy solution. I mean, I personally think having interplay between different groups makes us stronger as long as we remain separate. So I'm not as radical as you are in some of these things, and you and I have had conversations about that, Billy. But I agree with you that the whole concept that we can get through this without conflict and without struggle has one huge cost that no one's factoring in, which is the loss of anything that distinguishes us. You know, as much as our opponents talk about diversity and they talk about culture and they talk about, you know, potential, what they offer is a middling mediocrity that brings everyone down to the bottom and the lowest level. And if you have an aspiration and a belief that you can be something better, the creation of such an act requires an act of destruction to enable it. It requires, just like if you're in a forest, you got to burn the dead wood so that the healthy forest can live. And once upon a time, when we were people who lived much more simply, close to nature, we understood this because it was part of the cycle of life. But now that we are so protected and insulated in our lives in so many ways, we don't understand this. We don't connect with nature. And we think in our artifice, we can cheat not only death, but cheat having to face questions of death in both giving it and taking it. And to someone who's never faced it, who's never even done something so simple as making their own meal, you know, and understanding that chicken you ate was once a living bird that was a breathing thing that you or someone else killed, is how life is sustained. is something that is so deep and so profound, and we are so insulated from it. And without understanding that, it just seems to me we cannot advance our civilization. We cannot advance our people. We can't advance these questions because we are too afraid. And I give you credit for speaking openly and bluntly on that. I mean, I will tell you, there are times people tell me that, you know, oh, why do you talk to Billy? He can get you in trouble. I do it because you're honest, and I respect that about you. And I, you know, even if I don't 100% agree, at least you have the courage to say the truth that people won't, which is that you can't have everything without it getting a little ugly sometimes.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you're exactly right. You know, when you think about where we are in terms of spiritually and psychologically as a civilization, as a population, how can we expect a bunch of vegan soy boys, like you say, who cannot go out to the field and process a cow to make hamburger because they literally are afraid of the idea of death being part of the cycle of life? They're literally afraid to get their hands dirty even to preserve their own life. How can we expect them to earn the right to make choices about our lives? We're dealing with a population, well, I don't believe in democracy, because we're dealing with a population of sheep who have consciously, like you said in the beginning, they've consciously abdicated the responsibility of making the difficult decisions necessary in life about our people's future collectively. They've abdicated that responsibility to people who do not care about our people's future, people who take it to the top, the elite, the establishment, whatever race they belong to, are only motivated by what? By the same thing that you discussed, by individualism, by the greed and the selfishness. So what individualism leads to are these oligarchs who are only concerned about being billionaires and protecting their own financial self-interest and will betray their own race, their own nation, their own faith, their own family for their own position. And that's what individualism and selfishness, as opposed to collectivism, leads to. If you want to see what individualism leads to, look at every Anglo-Shabbos Goy politician who has sold out to the Jews. That's what individualism, as opposed to collectivism, leads us to. And then you have, you know, the Democrats, the people who are at the bottom, who think that they should have an equal voice in the future of our people and our nation, as you and I should, when they have room to mature IQs at best. That's why democracy does not work. Because those people always, they individualistically, selfishly vote their self-interest, and then the politicians are able to take our tax dollars and to fund part of those individual self-interest and to buy the votes of the rabble to stay in power and to increase their power to, once again, in cyclical way, promote their own individualist self-interest, all as a abject rejection of collectivism. So we have people at top who are individualist, profiting from their positions of power, which they maintain only to promote themselves as individuals, anti-collectivist. And you have people at the bottom, Democrats, keeping them in power, I don't mean Democrats in terms of party, but in terms of political system, keeping those individuals at the top in power because they're only interested in their own individual self-interest and voting to promote those self-interest. Now, identity politics is beginning to destroy that and cause the polarization and division of this country and other countries because it's enforcing a new collectivization and return to racial interest as collective interest, which is really kind of trumping, no pun intended, individualism and selfishism. Yeah, but people who abdicate the responsibility to even make their own meals, they've abdicated the responsibility to run their lives, and they don't want to make those hard choices. So they should not have any say in the future of our race or our people. So let them advocate it. And you know what? There's always been a greater need for serfs than there has been for nobles. Those people don't matter. They're tomato fodder, really. And I could really care less what their opinions are. And I'm not being an intellectual elitist when I say that. I'm being honest because those of us who are willing to sacrifice more for our people, obviously, you know, have earned the right to have some responsibility that we bear. It's not a blessing. It's, if anything, I would say a curse, but it's a duty that we bear. And it's heavy, you know. There are times in my life when I would wish that I could just be a normal guy, and I could have been a college history professor and been content you know, to live an upper middle class lifestyle and read a bunch of books and that kind of thing. But the reality is, that's not what was chosen for me. The people who advocate the responsibility to make those hard decisions
for not what you chose for yourself. Let's be a little simpler about this, right? Because that's what distinguishes nobility. The fact that when you see a problem and you have the opportunity, whether it's you as a teacher or me as a town manager, when we saw something that didn't add up, that was against the interests of our people, that we went ahead, we knew the easy decision, we took the hard decision because we knew it was the right decision. Yeah, and I think that's what we're at. You know, I think democracy is so sapping of the will. And the thing about it is it's the illusion of choice. It makes it seem like everything is a choice, so nothing is a choice, right? And it's the way through which the existing oligarchy controls people because it prevents the organization of effective opposition by depriving us on nonsensical issues at the middle while they sort of control and run away with things. And I hate to say it, but the solution is not going to come as simply as the ballot box. Now, I do think there's a lot to be said for electing better people, and I think that there is a way this system can evolve more intelligently into something better. But even our founders purposely put in a ton of protections to keep the mob, as you said, from running things. And so I guess where I'd like to take this now is, you know, we talk about, you know, that there is an existing, let's use the word aristocracy instead of oligarchy. I think that's better, the rule by the best. What is it that distinguishes those people? How can they rise to the top? And understanding the very explicit situation in which we find ourselves, how do we go ahead and manage that? I think that's a question that we need to kind of look at for the future, because I agree with you in the broad stroke that we need to have people who can make better decisions be the ones who are designing our future if we're to have one, because this idea that every opinion carries equal weight is an insane thing which we accept in no other idea except when it comes to government, to literally giving the power to people who use guns to control how we live and to take our income to make decisions. And you wouldn't do that with a doctor. You wouldn't ask a bus driver to operate on you. You wouldn't ask, you know, a mute to sing. Yet we, for whatever reason, to use the word you used, abdicate our responsibilities away from people who can make better decisions. And I think one of the reasons why that happened, I mean, Herodotus talked about this a lot, as did Thucydides a little bit, is that the problem is, in Western society, is that the elites who we used to have, who once upon a time took serious their responsibility to the people beneath them, have now chosen as the class apart to abandon the people which once served them. And if we understand the nation properly, which once represented a sort of grouping of people who had shared identity based on blood and kin, which, you know, is what race sort of is if you really get into it at a deeper level. It's just an extension of that. That, you know, now our elites have just sold us all out. And maybe, you know, they've imagined their better future is one where we don't belong and maybe we just missed the boat. Sometimes I kind of wonder that, and I look at that, and I mean, even if you look at it from the perspective of looking at how Zionists do it, they actually approach the question quite logically for the benefit of their own people. It's just we seem unable to get around our sort of fixation on our own feelings, on individualism, and on a sort of abstract ethics that are, we make individual ethics into some higher ideal when in fact it's really just a codification of a juvenile attitude of don't tell me what to do. And if we keep saying that so long while we're just fighting with ourselves, civilization is going to pass us by. And I wonder how we get past that, because if we're really honest about white civilization, we squabble a hell of a lot with each other. And being intelligent does not make us less likely to be confrontational. And so I guess I wonder how we find that balance going forward between, you know, people who can think and show the sort of leadership, you know, who can lead the flock along, because that's the responsibility of a leader, as well as, you know, understand that, you know, you can't abandon them either, that you have to be, as the Bible would call it, a good shepherd. And I would close with that by saying that you are right that it is a damning responsibility, because if you really think about what you have to do to change this and you imagine the blood on your hands and the things, a person would have to be truly soulless and sociopathic to not understand and be, you know, have pause in some of the decisions that are made and asking why the awareness of this exists. But, I mean, I think the saddest thing that we see over and over again are the number of people who actually know these things and they know they exist, but they pretend they don't so they can pretend that they're not making a choice. And the truth is they're choosing to benefit the present at the expense of our entire future. And in my personal opinion, they're pissing on the history of every ancestor who came before them so that they would have a chance to be here and every one of us who might follow so that we might realize a better fulfillment of whatever it is God has planned for all of us.
Exactly. As a self-aware sociopath, I'd have to respond by saying you're absolutely right to call those people, you have to call them the deep state. They're an aristocracy. Think about the examples of what they do. They obviously, Hillary Clinton's daughter, Chelsea, she got out of college and immediately got a $900,000 a year job. John Kerry's daughter got a job in the State Department with, you know, $400K a year for doing nothing. Countless examples. So what did they do to propagate their power? They actually do establish themselves as an aristocracy. And that's why, you know, it is like a competition between the Bush clan and the Clinton clan, right? But those people who have willingly sold out, and they may have made that choice. They may have, I believe, bet on the wrong horse, though. But the reason why I say that is because they have calculated, may have gambled that identity politics will not be a factor in the future. They have calculated against the natural course of entropy destroying nation states and the balkanization effect of multiracialism and multiculturalism. They have actually bet on Zionist and globalist forces being able to hold things together. I think that's the wrong way to bet. I think they're going to lose. And when they do, you know, those gated communities and those McMansions are not going to do them very much good. All those, you know, diverse third world lords that they were happy to bring in as long as they were separate from them are going to see them as no different from us. And they're going to be, the victims are going to be, you know, Shakespearean sense, hoisted on their own petard. But in between now,
let me ask a question because I'm curious of your opinion on this. Do you ever imagine, though, as some people do, that in fact that when you see the fights that are being structured, where we eventually, if things work out like you and I think, wind up fighting these people, that there maybe isn't a third hidden hand that's basically trying to organize the destruction of all these different competing groups so that they can realize the ultimate victory over us all due to exhaustion? You know, I think of how Islam spread after the Parthians and the Byzantines had fought for many, many centuries, and they were able to just sweep right in there out of the desert to the Middle East. And I cannot help but wonder sometimes if we're not in a similar role where we're forcing ourselves to run the gauntlet and we have no other choice. And maybe that makes us stronger, but maybe it also makes us so exhausted that we might be vulnerable. And a lot of people ask me that. I mean, I can't tell you the number of people who ask me and say that, you know, they want to fight. They want to see something happen. They want to stand up for their people. But on the other hand, they worry that it's just being set up to pick the wrong fight. And they're so scared that they're not picking the right one. Because even these oligarchs, I mean, they're so venial and in a culture where they're not really the threat. They're just the bodyguards for it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and if there's a third party, an unseen hand, if you will, we can't see it. We can't fight it. And in terms of military tactics, we may not always be able to choose what hill we fight on, but sometimes you have to fight. And
no, we can't charge Little Round Top again. Don't do it. Don't do it, for the love of God. Listen to a Yankee, for God's sake.
Right. So I sincerely believe that there are forces at work, forces of nature, if will, or forces of human will that are larger than any of us and larger than any of our abilities to slow down or speed up. That may be thought of as unseen forces, you know, ripples in the pond that are rocking our boats, but really we can't even calculate those things. We certainly can't face them or countermand them. We have to deal with the reality that we face. And so, yeah, I may recognize, for example, that I believe that Jews use pushing open borders and immigration of non-whites into our country to make whites a minority because they know through their bitter history in Europe 109 times that they're less likely to be pogromed if they live in a multiracial country rather than a homogeneous white country where they're the only minority. So that's their interest. I understand that. So, however, You know, I will still oppose illegal immigrants coming into my community, even though I know they're just a symptom of the Jewish problem. I cannot, at this time, directly attack the Jews, and there are many of our people who are not psychologically ready to do so. So I can mobilize them to fight the symptom of the disease, like a doctor might fight the symptom. You know, if you go to have a rotten tooth pulled out and you have a systemic infection because of it, the doctor's going to give you antibiotics to fight that systemic infection before he pulls that rotten tooth. So we have to be able to attack the symptom sometimes before we can even attack the cause.
Let me ask, and I'll close with this question, because I think you and I could talk for several hours, and I intend to invite you back because I have some questions about time and being I want to get into, and there's nothing like Heidegger to make a nice, light conversation. But who do you think is the end boss, really, in a cosmic sense, not just in a sense of the temporal of what people are motivated, but I know you're a man of faith. You've talked about that, and you've talked meaningfully about your struggles with it, to lose it, to find it, to what it means to you. So what do you see as motivating? You know, what is evil, and I guess is what I'll close with. What is the end boss?
Let me tie it up in a knot like this. We talked about individualism tonight. We talked about selfishness tonight. We drew a contrast between collectivism and individualism, between martyrdom and heroism and selfishness. The greatest evil, in terms of my faith, is defined by Lucifer. Lucifer was on the right hand of God. He was God's favorite. His name means, you know, son of the morning star, the bright one, the fair one. He led a rebellion in heaven with one-third of the angels fighting against God, and they lost, and they were cast out. And now that's the devil and the demons, their former angels, the hype. Why did Lucifer rebel against God? If the devil is the ultimate evil, and Lucifer is that personification, he rebelled against God out of selfishness. I'll explain that. He was jealous of God's relationship with humans. He felt that he should be God's favorite still. God preferred mankind, preferred us to him in his eyes. And that was the resentment building, envy, and selfishness that caused Lucifer to rebel against God. So once again, collectivism versus individualism. If Lucifer had been a collectivist, he would have done what was in the best interest of the collective greater good, and there would be no Satan. And that was not part of God's plan. But yeah, I'll close with that. The greatest evil, Lucifer, Satan, is individualism.
Well, I think with that sort of deep revelation, I would just end by saying that a small prayer that I hope that we try to find God's will and to do that and to do so wisely, because it's very hard to know these things. But I think the willingness to question oneself, to always ask difficult things and to seek out those answers is so important. And I appreciate you coming on here and sharing some of this. I think it was a fascinating conversation, Billy. It always is. And I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did.
Very much. I always enjoy our talk. You know, I don't even have to be recorded to enjoy my conversation with you, but that just makes it a bonus.
Well, I know that. So let me, before I go, if there's anything that you'd like to plug, obviously let people know about the Roper Report, your writings, and anything else. So if people want to learn more or reach out to you, you might want to mention the Shield Wall briefly, because I know you invest a lot of time and passion into that.
Thank you. That's very generous. I try to make a new political or news commentary article every day for the Roper Report website, which people can find at whitenationalist.com. The Shield Wall Network is white nationalist preppers preparing for the coming civil war by creating in real life friendships, and that can be found at aryanwarrior.com. I have 15 published books, fiction and nonfiction, available through amazon.com, barnesandnoble.com, booksamillion.com. Just Google Billy Roper Books. And coming up this next weekend, in a few days, I'll be going to northern Kansas for a seminar I'm leading in the upper Midwest on in-real-life activism to expand our network in that direction. And then the weekend after, I'll be in northern Texas for the Arklatex Regional White Unity Conference. So, yeah, you know, we stay pretty busy. This is a full-time commitment. It's like, you know, the difference between a, when it comes to a steak and egg breakfast. You've heard that joke. When it comes to steak and egg breakfast, you know, the chicken is devoted, but Yeah, the cow's really committed. So we're really committed. We stay, really stay on that griddle. But I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you, and I'd be happy to come back on your show anytime.
All right. Thank you, Billy. And thank you to everyone who listened. The podcast, as always, is hosted at nationalright.us/podcast. I'll have it up on Gab here, and we welcome you to share it. Once again, Billy, thank you for coming on.
Thank you. Happy day.
Good night.